Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Bros Pod is, of course, brought to you by BetOnline. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to wager on all of your favorite sports, contests, and events with first-to-market odds and lines. Find reviews and news for every league, Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA, NHL, combat sports, esports, and even golf. BetOnline continues to be the top online resource for all your sports information, from live in-game betting, props, to futures. Head to BetOnline today or use your mobile device to join today and make your first sports bet. Use our promo code BLEAV50, that's BLEAV50, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another version of Bill Roden on Sports. I'm Bill Roden. Summertime Bill in a undisclosed but pretty location, upstate New York, freshly credentialed for the U.S. Open, Roden. And holding it down down in Brooklyn is my friend and co-host, the great Jamal Murphy. Murph!
What's up, Bill? How's it going?
It's all good.
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn. I just came back from Queens. Like you said, getting that U.S. Open credential. It's already packed out there.
Yep.
You can just imagine Monday night for some.
Oh my God!
Could be the last match.
It could be her last match until she, you know, she gets tired. Says, you know what? I can't go out like this.
That's true.
Hopefully. Straight sets to some 15-year-old. You know? I can't. I got to at least go out in the semis, you know.
Yeah. And her opponent, I've never heard of before, Danka something.
She's heard of Serena. That's the problem.
Yeah, she's heard of Serena. And so I'm sure she'll be up for it. And like I said, I just can't wait for the atmosphere. What the crowd will be like.
Yeah, standing ovations. And
right.
You know, I'm sure it'll be very, very emotional, and it'll probably be emotional for the 15-year-old whoever's playing her. What's her name?
Danka something.
Oh yeah, okay. Goober.
Trust me, you've never heard of her because I've been watching tennis. And I never heard of her.
Yeah. So what do you scrape these people? Well, she had to qualify.
Yeah, she must have qualified without having to go through the qualifying rounds. So, you know, I'm sure she's pretty good. And Serena, you know, she's on the comeback. So there's no telling what level she'll be at. That's why this really could be her last match.
Yeah. And then the question becomes, you know, is this how you want to go out? You know, and then, but maybe you have no choice, you
right.
know, because this is like, if she wins Monday, then she got to play again Wednesday. Right. Then she got to play again Friday. I mean, it's a lot.
Right.
You know. Meanwhile, Venus is – do we know anything about Venus? Do we know what she's playing?
She's definitely in – you know, she's qualified for it. I don't know if she's playing on that same day or not. I think she probably plays on Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, because Venus ain't – she ain't mouthed the word retirement. No. Anyway, so Jamal's picked up his U.S. Open credential. We were kind of riffing about Serena, but we'll talk about that a little later. Our guest is the great Solomon Wilcots, a friend of the show, and somebody who I have extraordinary respect for. And I was thinking about today, man, when are you gonna get your own show? I mean, I know you got Moving the Chain. I mean, the opening drive. You do the opening drive on Sirius NFL Radio, which is must listen to radio. I don't miss a segment. You know, throughout the, right. I always listen to the opening drive with Solomon Wilcox and his array of all-star co-hosts. But I'm just wondering, man, what next? I mean, you know, and I hate when people do that, man. When are you gonna write another book? Fuck,
man. I still have to write the first one.
Yeah.
One. And Bill, you know this. When you write a book, particularly about yourself,
right.
For whatever reason, I feel like it's giving someone the game plan, right? For whatever reason, yeah, I've done that for years as a journalist. You know, when I want to go in and do something with Bill Belichick, I try to read as much as I can about him. And you know, that's the hardest code to crack. And then he writes the book, Son of a Coach. And now I feel like, oh, now I got the playbook on him, right?
Right.
And so I just kind of feel like I'm going to wait until I'm really totally out of it before I go in and publish my memoirs. But it's something that certainly is a project that I think we all have to do eventually.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I was not less thinking about your memoirs, but just another type of radio or TV show. I mean, you know, where it would be hosted by you. Like I said, yeah. I know you do the opening drive, but, you know, something in addition to that, other than that.
Well, I do a Believe in Bengals podcast, by the way, that you can catch where you can go onto the Believe Podcast Network, or you can go to believe.com, BLEAV. I do that show with Adam Pac-Man Jones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's actually televised here in Cincinnati because it is for Bengals fans. And so that's become a pet project of mine. So those are the really only two shows that I do. And that keeps me plenty busy. As you well know, I work with a PR firm that sort of takes me outside of sports, but still allow me to do what I do. And it allows me to help a lot of people in the medical science area of when it comes to clinical trial recruitment, investor relations. It's something that allows me to expand myself. So that's, it really does take up a lot of my time now. So for now, that's what I'm doing, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
The morning show you do, I mean, that, like you said, that's every morning. Like how much time and preparation goes into that? Like just that by itself.
Yeah, that's a good question. I do have a producer that pretty much, you know, that does a lot of the booking of the talent, but I do all the producing. I do all of the storylines. I build out the rundown in terms of the content that we're going to be talking about. And so, listen, it takes a lot of time. I'm usually putting in about 3 hours the day before, the night before we do the show the next morning at 7 a.m.
Right.
So how big a gift is the Deshaun Watson thing? We're all looking to fill up airtime. What kind of gift is that? before we get into the substance of it, we're a few days down the road, but in the media we're such whores. You know, when something like that happens, there's no shortage of filling up airtime.
That's right. And I went ahead and I chronicled. I went back and did a timeline. We're well over 18 months into this process. So you're talking about a lot. That's a lot of time going back to the end of the 2020 season in January. It really was January 2021, right? And now we're right into what? August of 2022. So, you know, we're significantly past a year and a half of this story, sort of this steady drumbeat, day by day, week by week, month by month. And yeah, they filled it up pretty good. And I don't want to say I want to thank Deshaun Watson, because this is one of those deals where it's pretty sketchy, you know. It's like I sort of flex in between. It's clear he has cleared the legal hurdle. Two grand juries have failed to indict. I think we've got to take that into note. If this was a family member of ours,
right.
If he was, we would be saying, look, you know, he hasn't been found guilty of anything. Not even a grand jury would indict him with these allegations. And there's no evidence to indict. However, I don't know that he's cleared the moral hurdle. And we always know the moral bar is so much higher. But I think it's part of our conversation. It's part of our dynamic. You and I both know it's part of our community, right? We have mothers, we have sisters. And so I don't want to be overly judgmental in any way, shape, or form, because if it were my son, I would say, look, none of us want to be tried in the court of public opinion. We would want the facts to sort of, you know, be the deciding factor. But there are some moral things here that I do think that we have to keep in mind in order to hold people accountable as well.
Yeah. What are the moral considerations? I mean, well, let's start this. What I had a couple thoughts. A, when you talked about your PR firm, I was thinking whoever did Deshaun Watson's PR at his post sentencing press conference should be fired. You know, it was awful. So let's start there and work our way back. What did you think of his? He did two things. One was a written statement, which is fine. Then he goes out in front of the firing squad, which is us. And it wasn't so great. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I think it could have been handled a whole lot better. You know, here's I think what we can say now, because we have been able to read some more about the case, learn a little bit more. I'm not saying that we know everything, because I don't think we do. But I think we know enough to know that he's not completely innocent here. You know, we don't typically find ourselves in situations such as this, having done zero,
right?
Like you can't say I've done absolutely not.
Right.
Okay, you got 26 allegations, man. And from what the judge is saying and what's in some of these depositions, you know, there are some things that you need to be accountable for. Not saying that legally, because I think that's what we straddle in between. I'm not saying he broke any laws legally, because that hasn't been proven, but morally, there was some improper behavior. At the end of the day, we do know, and I think the judge was able to decide that he violated the code of conduct policy that's been collectively bargained between players and the league, and he is a player, right? So he has to abide to this policy, and he did not. He did not put forth behavior that would clear the hurdle, right? So he violated that policy. So I think that's where we have to say he's accountable, and he never addressed it verbally. Like in these press conferences, he's never addressed that. He never showed any contrition. Now, maybe part of that, as you well know, on the legal side,
right,
when you're in the process of trying to settle,
right,
you don't speak to that. Everybody knows if you're under scrutiny, could potentially come under trial, you don't speak to that. So in that point, you should have never stepped to a microphone to address. That's what a PR firm would tell you. We're not answering any of those questions. We're going to let the case run its course. And once that has happened, and once, you know, this thing is behind us, then we can talk. No one would allow a client, family, a friend, a loved one, or anyone to speak when there still can be some kind of judgment out there and you can end up self-incriminating. Okay. So yeah, that's just a lot of people don't like it because it doesn't look good in the public eye. I'm one of these people when they talk about optics, I get it.
Right.
But you and I both know none of us want to be judged by what it looks like.
Right.
But we tend to do that. But we tend to do that, Bill, right, to others, right? We like, well, the optics were poor. Well, what if that were you? What if that were your family member? Would you want to be judged on what it looks like or what it is?
Right, right.
But we're always straddling in between those worlds, right? Trying to appease everyone, when in reality, we still have to make sure that we don't self-incriminate. We have to make sure that we don't make matters worse by the things that we said.
So what about when you look at the NFL? I mean, you know, you've been involved with the NFL for a long, long time, played in the league, been working in the sport ever since. When you look at the NFL, what's your take on how, where we are now? He got 11 games. Did the right sentence or whatever you want to call it from the NFL, did it come out correctly? Did they handle it correctly in the long run?
See, I think that's a really good question, Jamal, because that's been said a lot. A lot of people weigh in. You and I both know you could take 10 people and 10 different people and on something like what you just asked me would have a different answer. And I'm sure they would lay out some facts to maybe offer some evidence to why it should be 6 games or 7 games or 11 games or maybe even a whole season. But here's where I come down on that. The league, when we had the Ray Rice case, there was no governance, okay? There was no agreement on how to handle an issue like that. The league totally botched it, right? Well, this time around, they actually, before this ever happened, they came to an agreement with the players, with the league, decide a process, one, and two, how they would go about handling it. They followed that process. And even the commissioner, while he may have sought cover by designating someone else to rule on his behalf, it was still settled between Deshaun Watson, Players Association, and that designee who the commissioner put in his place. And they came down to 11 games. So my answer to your question is they followed a legal process that both sides agreed upon. And while no one got all of what they want, right, it was a process that was a legal process that was done by legal minds, right? And that's pretty much kind of what it is. Typically, when you have a fair deal or close to what's fair, both sides are unhappy. Neither side got all of what they want. They had to do something that we don't do in Washington anymore. Right. They had to compromise.
Right.
But they stuck to a process that was governed by law, that was governed by men agreeing, which is something we ought to find a way to do more often.
Yeah.
We don't always get what we want when we do that, but at least we stuck to the process and we allow that to lead us to where we're at. And that's how we got to 11 games.
Yeah. I thought, and again, speaking of evolution, I know we spoke about this back in March when all these allegations came out. You know, the discussion then, at least my first instinct was, you know, here's his brother who was taking this. Remember, he had taken this very principled stand against the organization. You know, he felt they had betrayed, maybe a strong word. But they reneged on an agreement to get him say so, and who's going to be the next coach, who's going to be the next GM. And he felt a sense of affront that they didn't do that. And at that point, he announced, I no longer want to play for you. I don't want to even play for the organization. At that point, like, that was a very principled stand that this guy's taking on his franchise. He said, I don't want to play for you anymore. I want out of here. And seemed to have them by the you-know-what, you know.
Yeah.
And almost at just when you thought that he had ultimate leverage, all these allegations kind of came out. So my first instinct was, damn, you bite the hand that feeds you. All of a sudden, they withdraw protection. That was the first take. Now, here we are months later, and I'm thinking, man, you know, like you, you know, this looks bad. I mean, even if they protected you against what? That you did something. Yeah. And I was almost to the point, I said, man, this guy probably needs 15 games, because 15 would then, although it's not the season, by 15, the team would probably say, you know what? What's the point of bringing him back and shutting him down? So I was even thinking, going from March to August, man, give this guy 15 games, you know, be more strict. How did your thinking evolve from March, the principal stand, all the allegations to now?
Yeah, I think you did a really good job of describing what that evolutionary process all entails, right? The initial part of it when he told the Houston Texans, I no longer want to be your quarterback. He didn't like the treatment. He didn't like being promised one thing and then another. Not that he was trying to run the organization, but he wanted to they had promised him things. There was some communication, and he felt like that was it was all smoke and mirrors. And so he and his heart and mind, he couldn't go on to work for him. And he was willing to walk away from all the money they signed him to be honest with you. And literally, in my timeline, it was within a month that a first allegation came forward. And then there was this sort of cascade of allegations, right, day after day after day. And you said, okay, is this part of what we've seen in the past, part of discrediting someone? Because remember, there were fans who were picketing the Houston Texans for not adhering or at least treating Deshaun Watson better. Right. I mean, all the fans were on his side going up against the Texans. And now you start to see these allegations come forward. And you and I, we've seen this before. I mean, you can go back to the Hoover days of what do they do when someone is standing on principle? What is the first tactic? Is to discredit that person, right? Discredit them with
your name.
You flood the zone with all these things. So therefore, your truth is ignored. You could be out crying in the wilderness, all your own truth. But if you discredit it, no one is going to hear you. No one's going to believe you. Falls on deaf ears. And I remember as this mounted, I asked the question, why we really should be asking the question, did Deshaun Watson sexually harass these 24 to 26 women?
Right.
We also should be asking the question, did the Houston Texans and the attorney, Tony Busby, are they using these women to attack Deshaun Watson?
Right.
I still think it's a fair question.
Right.
Did
they enable him?
And did they enable
him while he was doing that? Because
that's
some of the information that came out and nobody really talks about.
Of course.
It's kind of been
talked about that.
But it was in the Texas, in Texans facilities. They had to know what was going on.
The Texans have already settled lawsuits against them.
No, see,
here's where we're at. It's like the LIV and the PGA Tour.
Right.
Everyone wants to criticize the individual. No one wants to criticize the governing bodies, the major stakeholders, in this case, team owners, clubs. We as Americans have to become better when it comes to understanding the nuance of these issues. We seem to always want to blame the low-hanging fruit. You can take NIL in college football. Now, all of a sudden, the players are sort of like revolting against the NCAA. No one wants to take into account that the Supreme Court told the NCAA, you need to go fix what you're doing here. Right. It's not going to stand. You are not going to like what we render, the judgment we're going to come to, if you don't go and fix it. And now, guess what? The Supreme Court said, you know what? Name, image, and likeness. These kids have a right to benefit and profit from that. And the NCAA, and now you have some coaches who are starting to come around, right? Because they get it.
Right.
But initially, everyone wanted to blame them. This is why LeBron James said he wasn't going to go to college. I don't need that. I can go and make my money. I know what you guys get out of me going to college. But LeBron James became the first player in U.S. history that while he's still playing to become a billionaire. So he's proven that you can still self-educate, you can still grow and evolve as a human being, circumvent the NCAA and all of what they got going on and keep it moving. And so I think we as people need to understand that we should not just be picking on the lowest hanging fruit, getting back to Deshaun Watson, but also look to hold others accountable, right?
Exactly. And it's, you know, so often, even when you look at labor disputes between players and teams, fans, workers, and again, we complain about this even in politics. How can people act against their own interest You're a worker. Right. You know, you're a That's worker. Right. And this person is just trying to do what you're trying to do, is get as much money from these entities as they can. You know, but yet fans invariably will take the players, I mean, will take the franchise aside, just like you're saying now. They'll take the NCAA side, or they'll take the Browns side, or the NFL side. And so you're right. So what did Curtis Mayfield say? If there's a hell below, we're all going to go. Because it was a franchise. It was Deshaun. It was, and who knows? I mean, to some extent, this is sort of, you're not supposed to say this, you know, even some of the masseuses. I mean,
there's a lot of
complicity here. But the bottom line is, you know, basically, do you believe women? You know, that's the sort of default thing. So, yeah, but I'm with you, man. You know, there's a lot of guilt going around. Then you even had the owner, the co-owner of the Browns, D. Haslam, saying that this is such a wonderful thing that this gives us an opportunity to talk about sex trafficking, you know, and you're like, what the hell are you talking about? This has nothing to do with sex trafficking.
You know what that was an attempt to do? Try to pivot away from the folks, putting the focus on them and Deshaun Watson. And she was trying to throw the media a bigger fish, right?
Yeah.
and hoping the live trucks will run to it. That's an old PR tactic that sometimes people do fall for, but not in this case.
Yeah. That's what we want.
Yeah. But, sex trafficking. What about, no, D, the Robert Kraft thing had to do with sex trafficking.
Right.
I mean, although that's not exactly the same. We're not in the same pew, but we are definitely in the same church.
That's right. But if you want to apply it to the people you should apply it to, say, oh, they don't want to have that conversation. It's, you know, psychologically, it's been proven that we as people, we're all what we call aspirational, right? We aspire to be landowners. We aspire to be stakeholders in large corporations. And so we tend to side, like you said, we go against our own best interests, and because we're all workers, to be honest with you. Right. We really are. Even if you own a small company, you have clients and you have to answer to them. So we all have to answer to someone, but for whatever reason, we tend to lean toward the more aspirational element than the reality of the fact that we're all really in this boat together as workers. I'm surprised that we don't see things through the same prism that we tend to, you know, a lot of leaders have spoken about this. We tend to side with the ruling class, so to speak.
Right.
So
it's like a divide. There's also a divide and conquer element. You know, where's the message coming from? Who has the money to put the narrative out there and the effect that it has on people? And, you know, everybody, like you said, there's an aspirational aspect of it, but there's also, you know, there's that jealousy aspect of why should he succeed and I'm not, you know, you try to take people down instead of pulling yourself up.
And particularly in sports. I mean, when you talk about jealousy, Jamal, yeah, I mean, I think that's the root of all this. You know, a lot of these people, a lot of us, I mean, how many people get to play professional anything?
Right.
And a lot of people say, I would give my right arm to spend a week as a professional player. So here you are getting, you know, that, or here you are getting to play pro football or pro baseball. You should be grateful. I mean, I think that's sort of like the whole, you know, that might be a reason why people will take, will go vote against the athletes. You should be grateful.
Right.
I have an example. You know, Steve Bisciotti, he says, I just can't see why. And obviously Steve's looking at his own enterprise and what he's got to pay his quarterback, Lamar Jackson. And I respect Mr. Bisciotti in every way, the owner of the Baltimore Ravens. But he says, you know, Deshaun Watson, why should he be the first guy to get a fully guaranteed contract? They gave him $230 million and fully guaranteed. Why should he be the first guy? Oh, by the way, he wasn't. the first player to get a fully guaranteed contract, that occurred 2-3 years ago with Kirk Cousins with the Minnesota Vikings,
right,
to the tune of $83 million. Aaron Rodgers' contract earlier that he signed in January is fully guaranteed at $50 million a year. But no one said anything about those contracts being fully guaranteed. And so when you can throw out hyperbole or misinformation to heighten your disgust with the contract that Deshaun Watson, and no one fact checked, right?
Yeah.
No one's fact checked. They're like, yeah. So it's part of the jealousy. And then when you have to throw in misinformation to sort of get people to come on board with you, right? It really makes it that much worse. I had a guy tell me, why should Kyler Murray get that much money? Because his contract was probably equivalent to Deshaun Watson. Hey, he said, that's a lot of money. And I explained to him supply and demand, right? Like, how many people can do what he can do?
Right.
I said, no one's going broke paying him.
Right.
And you don't have a lot of people walking around the planet that can do what he can do. That's why you get the high salary. And that's pretty much across the board. That's called market supply. I said, these are true economic principles. And so in the layman's term, you know, the street, they say, don't hate the player, hate the game. Like, you know, if you don't like what the individual is making, then you should probably take the game or the system to task that's rewarding him, right, for having this rare skill that not many people have, but the market has answered and paid him this high salary because he has a rare skill.
Right. Yeah. Also a rare skill that he worked every day for how many years since he was a little kid and put all that time in as a guy who played, you know, high school and some college, like Division III college. I know I wasn't working as hard as those other guys who made it to the pros. So it's like a lot of these people think like, oh, the jealousy aspect, you're jealous because he's making all his money because they think it's just a skill he was born with. No. He had to work. He worked hours and hours and hours and hours when average people were with friends and in school and going out to eat and all that kind of stuff. They had to sacrifice that. And this is where they are now to go along with the natural skill I'm sure that most people have. But we don't even think, like, we don't think about any of that sacrifice. We just look at where they are now and think that they were born like that.
And he answered that really well, I thought, when he took to the mic to defend himself after this study clause that was put in the contract. Maybe it was put there to embarrass him, but he said, I find it very interesting that I'm being judged or criticized for not being a guy who works hard, for not having passion for what I do. Here I am at my height, at 5'9", drafted as a Major League Baseball player, first overall player picked in the draft, won a Heisman Trophy. And I've been able to accomplish all these things by not having passion for what I do or not working hard or not having the acumen to achieve these things. And I just thought the way that he handled it was very classy, and I thought he hit some touch points that we all know are taboos, right? That were stereotypical taboos used against someone who's an African-American quarterback playing in the NFL. And he touched on every single one of them without ever mentioning race. So I thought he was very skilled. It was a very skillful way of articulating what he was feeling and knocking down the criticism all at the same time.
Yeah, I think, well, this segues, your comments segue into a number of things. A, they segue into, when we talk about doing something since you were 5, that segues into Serena's retirement, because I want to touch on that. And just the idea of the R word, as I call it, just the whole notion of having to face the end of something, of a life, two different lives, you know, a life that is almost two deaths, right?
That's right.
The death we all face. But then if you're an athlete and you've been doing it since you were 5 and now you're 35 and suddenly it's over, that's got to be something. And I want you to talk about, A, Serena, but in your own, you know, your own dealing with that, you know, when you wake up and decide it's over, I'm not doing it anymore. But then just briefly, hold that thought for me, Jamal. But also when we talk about Kyler Murray, and I think about this whole, in the way the nation is so divided now, and I keep going back into sports, particularly the blood sports, basketball, football, where Black people have dominated, and there's no talk of affirmative action. There's no, you know, it's you look at a guy, I mean, a guy like Kyler Murray flips it on his head, you know, the exact opposite, being 5'8", working hard, or being a Lamar Jackson, or probably being anybody on every roster, any brother who's made it this far. And it's all about everything we're not supposed to be about. Hard work, discipline, sacrifice. You know, to me, the sports is somewhat almost of an antidote to all this other nonsense that's going on. We can just make shit up. You know, you can't make it up here. You really cannot make it up.
On the field.
It tells you that we live in this world that has multiple realities.
Right.
I have shared with some of my friends who are white, who I'm very close with and have worked with. And I said, you know, America is not just one thing. We have two Americas. We have maybe three. Like, you can go into the deep South, right? You can be Italian, right? You can go into the deep South. You leave New York. You leave one of the five boroughs in New York. As an Italian person going to the deep South, I think they'll find out, like, what?
Right.
Where am I? Right? Right. Now, you and I already know what that's like, so we know that that's not hyperbole. You can leave there and maybe go to, say, Alaska, right? It's going to be a whole different kind of environment. Go to L.A. or California, you're like, wow, experience some. Come to the Midwest, and now the value system changes even there, right? And so we all need to come to this understanding that there's going to be all the, but when it comes to our existence and our reality, I grew up in Compton, California, where Serena is from. That sport is not democratized in the way that boxing is,
right,
the way that football is. And what do we mean by that? You can come up from the grassroots and become, you don't need money to participate as a boxer, mm-hmm, right? You don't need to be sponsored as a football player. You know, basketball player, you pick up that ball, there's a hoop on every corner at every park, and you just go to play, right? But tennis was always a club sport. If you weren't part of a country club, if your parents couldn't pay for you to be a member of the club, it was going to be hard to come up as a tennis player or as a golfer, right? Even Tiger Woods' right. father could afford for him to, it taught him himself, but they could afford to get him teachers and,
right.
and get him the help he needed so that he could grow in the sport in a way that someone who didn't have the same economic situation could never achieve, could never accomplish. So when we talk about different sports, and that's what makes what Serena and Venus have done even that much more remarkable, because they did not have the economic base to come up in a sport that's totally controlled by economics. It's not fully democratized. And so for her to achieve what she's achieved, I think in that context, it's one of the greatest things we've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's one of the greatest careers in any sport that we've ever seen. And you talked about it earlier. Jackie Robinson said that the athlete dies twice.
Yeah.
It was Jackie Robinson who said that. And what he meant is, you're right, you're doing something that you love, that you passed since you were 5, 6, 7, 10 years old, in Serena's case, and she was a little girl.
Right.
It was the game that put her on a different trajectory in life. Taught by her father, she's seen it change the life of her entire family.
Yeah.
Generational wealth. And now to get to a place where you can't do it anymore, what if you told a doctor who went through med school and practiced and put in all those years, and now they're practicing medicine, and then at 40 years old, hey, you can't practice medicine anymore.
Right. Right.
Or a lawyer who went to law school, and now you're not going to let them in a courtroom anymore. That's where they compete. That's where they play, and that's where they perform. And now they're told you can't practice law anymore. Trust me now. Like many athletes, they're going to go through a deep dark place in their life. There's going to be some depression.
Yeah.
There's going to, not saying that it'll ruin their life. I'm just saying there's going to be this growth and this change that's going to have to, this metamorphosis, right? That has to take place. From Brett Favre to Peyton Manning to Tom Brady, I don't care how great you are, when you move away from the game, even Vince Lombardi said, that's going to be the day that you really start to mature because you're going to grow in other ways.
Right.
That growth, you and I know, growth doesn't come without pain. It's just part of the growth cycle. Every single one of us. In order to grow, there has to be an adverse, effect, this adverse element. And that's pain. We call them growing pains.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what we call it. So I had to go through it.
How old were you, Solly, when you decided that it was over? How old were you?
When I retired, I was 29.
Oh,
just
wow.
Before my, I was still young. So, wow. And my body was starting to break down. I wasn't making millions of dollars. I knew I could go do other things. So I was like, all right, I got to do it. But then when you step away, you realize that you were, your life was governed by this cycle, this regimen that you, did every single year in the fall. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. In the winter and in the spring and in the summer, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And while you knew you were signing up for a sport that you could never do forever, that you knew it was the career was shorter, very short, that you would have to have a second career. And I always worked and thought I was putting forth effort toward a second career. It's the primary thing that you do. Sports was the primary thing that I did. It governed that life cycle. It governed my energy. And, you know, when you're an athlete, whether you're in season or out of season, it's with you every day. Your training, your nutrition, everything, I'm telling you, it's with you every day. There's never a day that you're not thinking about what do I need to do today to be better. Tom Brady is sort of that living ideal of what I'm talking about, that example. But yeah, this Serena's retirement, you know, the R word, as you put it, I still struggle with it, at least in the life that I've been able to carve out for myself now professionally. I can't see myself ever retiring. I might evolve into doing something else.
Right.
But, you know, I'm always be working, Bill. I can tell you that right now. Because there ain't no alternative. My dad told me, he's a Baptist minister. He said, you know, when God made man, when he told us to come out of the garden, he said we were going to have to work until we returned to the ground from whence we came. And I tend to believe that. I believe we should just keep working because there ain't no kicking your feet up. I mean, I'm not saying you can't take a day or two off, but I'm not walking away from the things that I love. And I love the work that I do.
Yeah. No, that's so well said. And I was thinking about somebody like, you know, Serena. I mean, the thing that resonated for me when she said she didn't even want to think about it. She just called the R word. And I mean, that resonated because even for me, I felt a sense of terror. You know, like, what are you going to do, man? I mean, at least if you're a writer or a musician or art or whatever, you know, you can do this, quote unquote, you know, well, forever. I mean, like, there's got to be some line at some point.
That's right.
Physically unable to perform, you know.
That's right.
Some is later, sooner than later, you know, like the doctor who, you know, you read these books about the doctor who's a surgeon and suddenly something happens. And they've got shakes and they can't, they can't do that anymore. So I guess there comes a point in time, but shit, man, you know.
Gotta walk away.
Yeah.
Can I say one last thing about what I've consulted friends, colleagues, former teammates, when you've got to give up the thing you love as an athlete, right?
Yeah.
Or even in a career, I think the focus ought to be, how can I take what has been given to me, the knowledge that I've collected over the years of competing, and how can I help be a blessing to other people? Sometimes we got to stop looking inward and start looking outward. I believe if Serena makes up her mind that I'm going to impact the lives of many young ladies, of many people, taking what I've learned about the game of tennis, sharing it with the world, she'll find that her enthusiasm for life, it now is not about chasing titles or championships. It's about helping people.
Right.
Exactly. And now you go to a whole nother level of quality of life.
Yeah.
I think that's what we all have to really learn how, as competitors, we're always looking inward. When we come on the other side of it, you got to begin to look outward and look how you can help people. Be a giver.
Yeah.
And when you become that giver, when you become that person that's a blessing to others, I'm going to tell you right now, you'll be happier than you ever have been winning titles and championships, because all those things are self-fulfilling. The other stuff is what did it say? Better to give than to receive. It's true.
It is true.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. No, it is very true. And I was thinking, when we're talking about inventing Serena's, her future, you know, I remember talking to her dad once, and his vision, his dream was to establish a tennis academy, because his thing was, particularly in tennis, we can't count on white people to create our champions. That I would love to have a Serena and Venus to have like their own tennis academy. I was thinking for Venus, who is not, by the way, and said anything about retirement. She said, that's my sister, ain't me. You know,
ain't me. That's right.
I got to carry that burden. Like, every time you see me, I'm supposed to say, at this point, you just want to see me and play some good tennis. And
that's right. You know, that's right. I love her approach. Yeah, I love her approach.
Yeah, sister, where she got to go. We wait for her to, like, you know, win the Grand Slam. Venus said, ain't me, you know. But well, I was thinking how cool it would be for them to have an academy that really focuses on young women, you know, maybe young women of color who necessarily may not have, you know, all the means, you know, because they know the blind spots in the system. And
that's right. That's right.
And how gratifying would that be to have that kind of academy? And that's pretty much your focus is young women. And I'd say young women of color, you know.
That's right.
To just say, we have an idea of how to do this, you know.
Yep. That would be the ultimate give back. And, you know, I was always raised to understand that, hey, you leave it better than you found it.
Yeah.
You know, and if some way, shape, or form, Venus and Serena can reshape the game of tennis to where it is truly democratized, where you could be some kid somewhere in Harlem, right? Playing on a court where the weeds are coming up through the cracks of the court, right? And, like it was in Compton on some of the courts they played on. And now they're beginning to formulate the mind of a champion and then the talent that comes with being the champion. Because you and I both know starts up here first. And that's what, if you go and you look at and read any of the books on how they came up, they were busy. It looked like the dad was busy grooming Venus, and Serena had already started pointing to records that she was going to break. She had it going on up here. She knew what she wanted to do. She signed herself up to play in some of the tournaments her sister was playing in. Mom and dad didn't even know she was on the other side over there beating everybody, right? That's a mind of a champion now. They have such a phenomenal story.
It is a great story.
Of triumph, right? And overcoming. Yeah. And it goes to show you how, no, you don't have to wait on anybody else to help you, to come to rescue you. You're right. Her and her family, and certainly Serena and Venus, they have everything they need to be able to give to others
and help build
future champions in the world of tennis.
Yeah, in an intentional way. Because, I mean, I think they've already provided inspiration, but to do an intentional way in this camp, like I said, I'm spending their money. But I just think that would be such a powerful thing for them to do that and give back. Meanwhile, man, we've talked as usual, man. We've talked for hours. We could we could go on forever, man.
Really?
Yeah, I was telling somebody yesterday to kind of put a bow on the Venus and Serena thing. I agree with you. So I think that's one of the, that may be the greatest sports story in American U.S. history. The Venus and Serena story, I think, and they should there should be a statue of them in four Grand Slams. There should be a statue in Australia. There should be a statue in Roland Garros. There should be a statue right out here at the U.S. Open. And then there should be a statue. Which one am I? Am I missing one? Am I missing a major? Oh, Wimbledon. There should be a statue.
Wimbledon, Wimbledon.
There should be a statue of each of them and all else for what they have done for this sport.
Yeah. Because, let's face it, whether you're a champion like Joe Louis or Muhammad Ali, whether you're that sport is democratized.
Right.
You can come from the bottom up, from the lowest level of our society to become a champion in boxing. You can come from the lowest level of our society to become a champion in all the other major sports. But in a, what we call a single participating sport that is not democratized, that all the champions who have preceded them have come up through a system, okay, that's been thoroughly monetized.
Yes.
That's based on economics. Right. And so you could not come from the bottom, but their father allowed them to circumvent. He took them out of junior tennis because he saw the disruption to the human psyche, right? Of some of the young people, some of the young ladies, right?
Yeah.
Who that system had chewed them up, spit them out, and left them in really bad psychological shape. And he said, no, my girls are going to Disney World.
Right.
He said, I mean, he took them out of that system, but he found a way to work through it and then around it. And ultimately, they did get some financing and some funding. The mom and dad took the girls as far as they could to where these coaches saw something in them and had they wanted to work with them.
Right.
They wanted to work with them. Right. By then, it was a done deal, you know, but he had turned down money far many more times before he ever said yes, right? He walked away because he's like, nope, I'm not, my girls are not for sale.
Yeah.
You're talking about someone who got a bad deal now, because I've had people tell me, what about what their dad did to those daughters? I said, what? He should be father of the year.
Yeah, every year.
He's an example. He brought his daughters up. And look, I grew up in Compton. He brought his daughters up. And these girls didn't fall to early teenage pregnancy. They were straight A students academically. A lot of things that people don't even know that they were could have become susceptible to. He helped them navigate those pitfalls, right? Just to raise his girls up to. Listen, we all as fathers should be so lucky to be as good as Richard Williams was to his girls.
Yeah, man, that's so well said.
Before we let you get out of here, it is the NFL season.
Let's bring it back.
I know, right?
We are fans of on the field also. We can't help it. You know what I'm saying? You know, as we come into this regular season, what are you looking at in terms of what teams do you really like?
You see that helmet behind.
No, I like damn said I never seen that before. Have you done anything?
Hey man, right? Yeah, hey, man. Look, Joe Burrow has taken the league by storm, and rightfully so. And here is the reason why. Look, a lot of people look at the quarterback position and they love the style and the big plays and the numbers and the aerial artistry that comes with the passing game. This guy is cut from a different cloth in this. He's a quarterback, but he's not afraid to get his jersey dirty.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy, and I said this even before the Tennessee game, but I think that Titans game in the playoffs when he took out the number one seed Titans, I think it was a testament to his spirit as a competitor. And that's really what you look for in quarterbacks. When you strip them all down, you got to ask, who is the guy that don't mind getting hit?
Right.
Who is the guy that can take the punishment, keep getting back up, and going to find a way to beat you? Because I'm going to tell you right now, you get sacked 9 times in the game, 98% of the quarterbacks that have come through this league would tap out. Now, there's a few that they don't care. Johnny Unitas didn't care. Brett Favre didn't care. Ben Roethlisberger didn't care. There are some of these guys, I'm telling you, John Elway, they could take it. Steve Young, they could take the punishment. Joe Montana was a guy could take the punishment and keep ticking. But a lot of guys now, that ball start going deep, start going into the ground, start selling high. But Joe Burrow is that kind of competitor you can't count out. That's why I'm high on Bengals. I tell you, though, this is the one player, the Buffalo Bills have a quarterback in Josh Allen. It's not lost on me, guys. This guy did something no other quarterback has ever done in the history of our game against one of the best defenses, Bill Belichick's defense. Eight possessions, eight touchdowns.
Yeah, he pitched the perfect game.
The perfect game. No punts, no field goals, no fumbles, no turnovers, eight possessions, eight trips to the end zone.
That's right.
Never happened before in our game. He is not a dual threat quarterback. Right. He's a multi-skilled quarterback. The guy can not only run on a scramble, but he can run design runs. He can make all the throws. And the dude is 6'5" and will run you over. So when you have that plus a Leslie Frazier defense that ranks tops across, you know, they were the number one scoring defense a year ago.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Mm-hmm. Did you know they were top three in takeaways, top three in interceptions? Okay, so when you have a defense that wins across those metrics, don't allow you to score, they take the ball away at a high rate. They just got a guy by Von Miller to help the other young pass rushers to become. When you combine that with stellar play at the quarterback position, usually equates to champ. That's all I'm going to tell you. So those are my two teams. We haven't talked about the Chiefs yet, man, with Grim Reaper, because I love me some Patrick Mahomes. So, you know, we hadn't talked about the Bucs and we hadn't talked about the Packers yet. So, but those three teams in the AFC are my top three.
And then – you know, another thing we love, as you know, we love black quarterbacks on this show. We love them.
That's right. So
I got three young ones. I'm going to name three young black quarterbacks for you, and I want you to tell me who you're most excited about seeing, or who you feel the best about coming into this year. All right. We got Trey Lance in San Francisco, Justin Fields with the Bears, and Jalen Hurts with the Eagles.
Hey, those are three good ones. Trey Lance is the one I'm most intrigued by, and of those three, because I think he can be what we just described in Josh Allen. Mm-hmm. He can run the RPO stuff. He can do design runs. He can run the RPO, play action, scramble, and make all the throws. He just needs more reps, right? I think he's in a quarterback-friendly system. I think he's going to get coached up in all the right ways. I think his upside is – phenomenal. Remember Josh Allen's first 2 years, man, there were a lot of doubters. The guy couldn't even complete 60% of his passes in either one of those two seasons. And then he went from like 59% to 69, almost 70%, right? And it, from year two to year three. So Trey Lance, number one. Justin Fields, man, this is like getting stuck in a situation. Bad team. Right. He was with the coaching staff and GM didn't help him last year. So far, the GM and coach there, they drafted a bunch of defensive players and got rid of the good wide receivers and haven't built an offensive line. So this thing, man, you couldn't write it out any worse. How we're going to – this is how we're going to destroy a young quarterback. I tell you what we're going to do. That's kind of – the Bears are reading from that script. And I just left Chicago. The fans are – they're expecting maybe a 4 or 5 win season. I say it might even be worse.
Oh my God.
You know, and so he's gonna have to endure, and that's not easy to do in our league. Jalen Hurts is one of those guys, man. He's got the biggest swings between good and bad games. That game early in the season against Dallas last year, he was horrible. Then they went to the RPO deal. He ended up leading the team in rushing. They ended up leading the league in rushing and going to the playoffs. And then he gets into a playoff game against the Bucs and threw three interceptions. Yeah. He was as bad as I've seen him, but there's other moments where he looks really good.
Hmm.
And so I think he's just going to always struggle and vacillate with inconsistencies. We saw that at Alabama. Hmm. We saw it at Oklahoma. We saw him improve tremendously. And since he's coming to our league, I think he's a great leader. I think he gets more out of his abilities than anybody you'll ever know. I do think he can throw. I just think he's still working on the mechanics of becoming a more consistent thrower. And so that's why you get these fluctuations between moments where he's really good and looks like he's arrived, and then he gets a moment where he takes a couple of steps back. They say that when you're learning new behavior, in order to really improve, you're going to get worse before you get better. And then you're going to have these moments of inconsistency where you take two steps forward, one step back. And that's what we're seeing before our very eyes unfold with Jalen Hurts.
Yeah. And you can't let the show end. But Mike, I think that this whole black quarterback thing will, I'm going to say will end. This will never, I don't know when it will end. But when Lamar Jackson holds the Lombardi Trophy, I think because of the kind of guy he is, the type of player he is, the type of style he represents, it almost is, he's got to do that to, again, I'm not to say it's going to put all this to bed, but I don't think it'll put it to sleep temporarily, you know? So that's what I'm looking for. What do you think of Lamar and the possibility of that happening? Because I'm not sure how wide that window is.
And the fact he has no contract yet.
Right.
Yeah. So here's the deal. First, I'm aspirational. So I believe in my heart of hearts that we're going to be one day putting this stuff to rest, man. Right. But here's where we are. This will kind of show you exactly the dualities, the world that we live in as it pertains to Lamar Jackson, because he's must-see TV. Right. The guy has led the league in passing touchdowns. He's been an MVP, but for whatever reason, people still trying to think he can't throw. He led the league in touchdown passes. Right. You know, he's led his team to the playoff three straight years, didn't make it last year. But, you know, he doesn't have any major marketing deals. Neither does Joe Burrow. Everybody look at Baker Mayfield and say, maybe he shouldn't do as many commercials. He should focus on the game. And then Joe Burrow doesn't do all these big commercials. And they say, see, that's how he's focused on his craft. He's working on his craft. That's how, you know, no celebrity quarterbacks, what Bill Parcells said. Right. And Joe Burrow gets that. Mm. Somehow when it comes to Lamar Jackson, he doesn't get credit for that. Somehow it's at a default. Right. It's because of he's lacking something. Right. No, that's by design. Mm. He's intentional about what he's doing, but it's not seen through the same prism. Yeah. This shows you the duality of how we critique. And that's why we need to make sure, this league needs to make sure that we have a presence in the broadcast booth.
Right.
Because right now, too many of the things that we're doing in the game and our contributions to the game is being filtered through other people.
Right.
And they're filtering it and coming out with a whole nother context that got nothing to do with the reality of what's going on. Yeah. And if people don't understand that by now, then I don't think they'll ever get that. You got to understand when someone is announcing a game, he's giving you his interpretation of what he just saw.
Mm-hmm.
But that's filtered through his own experiences, through his own zeitgeist, right? Mm-hmm. Through his own life and understanding in psychology. And so why can't we have someone else who is probably more like the people who's out there doing it? How come we can't have that filter, right? And that's, I'm just sharing with you Lamar Jackson, Joe Burrow doing the same things, right? Seem totally different. He's representing himself. When DeAndre Hopkins represented himself, the Houston Texans told him, go kick rocks.
Yeah.
Go play for somebody else. You know, all he did is negotiate for himself the highest paid annual contract for any wide receiver ever in NFL history. At that time, it was $28 million a year. And it wasn't exceeded until 2 years later, until Devontae Adams and Tyreek Hill signed their deal.
Mm.
That's right. DeAndre Hopkins negotiated his own deal with the Arizona Cardinals, had been doing so with the Houston Texans. No one saw that as a fault. Yeah. Players do this every single day. There are a lot of players who represent themselves with consultancy.
Right.
he's consulting with attorneys, with marketing people, and then he goes in and talks for himself.
Yeah.
What makes him, what, why do we believe that's something that's beyond his abilities? I don't know. I don't think that, but some people tend to think that the deal isn't done yet because of that. I'm here to tell you it's done because he's a unicorn. His talent and his ability, we haven't seen anything like it combined. His ability to run, when he tucks that ball, his electricity, his competitiveness, like when he came back off COVID in the Monday night game against Kansas City, goes in, get IV fluids, come back out of that telephone booth, kept bringing his team back, willed them to victories. He's done it time after time. He saved the coach's job, got him a new contract, Got the GM's new contract. This guy was the last player picked in the first round in that year of 2018. And he's outplayed all of them, save I'll say he's on par with Josh Allen. But because he's the MVP, I'll say he's outplayed all of them.
Yeah.
Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, Josh Rose.
Now big time help.
So, listen, man, he going to get his money because I believe in the Ravens. The Ravens, they get it. You know, Greg Roman gets it. That whole offense is designed around him. No one else can do it like him.
Yeah.
When that guy, hey, ask the networks.
Right.
They love when he's on television.
Right.
Because ain't nobody going to get a beer. That guy is on the field. Right. I could just tell you that right now. Right. Must see TV.
Yeah, yeah. Well, man, I guess it's been the great Solomon Wilcox. Man, I can listen to your insights forever. We've been it for an hour and a half. You know,
really? Well, that's gone by like, man. I have fun talking with you guys. Man,
we can just kind of talk, man. You know, like it's all close to the barbershop. You know,
that's
maybe,
right.
Maybe that's right. Maybe that's what we should do. I had this when I was with the Times. I did, you know, my barbershop is in Harlem, and so
we did
three things in the barbershop. I brought David Stern up to the barbershop. Then I brought, I brought Roger Goodell to the barbershop, and I brought the great Jim Brown to the barbershop. I'll send you a link.
That's beautiful.
And it was very
natural. Man.
And I laughed when I saw remember when LeBron was trying to get on Nick Saban about.
LeBron,
you know, I did it before you. And I'm sure
that's right.
I stole it from somebody else, man. No.
Well, you know. See, everybody in our culture, because we were born, our fathers took us to barbershops and we sat there, and there's a certain etiquette that exists there. This is our culture, right? Yeah. This is African-American culture. And it's a very beautiful and wonderful thing because you can go in the most hardened hood.
Right.
And that old guy going to get treated with certain amount of respect.
Yeah.
The little kids coming in there going to get you. Hey, y'all can't talk like that. We got little kids
in
here.
Right.
You know, it's just it speaks to the heart of who we are in our community. It always has because you in that barbershop is the preacher, the pimp, and everybody in between. Let's be honest. Right, guys. but there's a space and a place for everyone, and it's interesting to see the respect that's given.
Yeah.
And man, I wish that could extend even outside beyond the barbershop, even within our own community.
Yeah, I wish. Well, speaking of aspirational,
who knows, man?
You know, we just have to keep our nose to the grindstone and run your leg of the relay as hard as you can. And that's all you can do is then hand it off, and you know, and make sure it's a clean handoff. Yeah. Make sure the person takes it from you. Don't give it to them. Make sure you
take it. That's right.
Then you run your race.
That's right, Bill.
You run your leg as hard as you could run. And then understand that this shit's going to go on forever. This is an eternal relay race. You know.
That's right.
So anyway, there's more to talk about, man. I look forward, man, to catching up to you during the season. Like I said, man, your show on Sirius NFL Radio. The opening drive is tremendous.
That's right.
And
I listen to your
thing with Pac-Man. I gotta listen to that.
Yeah, you gotta check it out. We had This past week we had, and you could go to the Believe Podcast Network or Believe.com, BLEAV.com.
That's what we're on, right?
Or wherever you get your podcast. Yeah. And you can, we just did an interview with Lou Anaromo.
Okay.
The Bengals defensive coordinator. Yeah, this is the guy that held, he held the Chiefs to 3 points in the second half twice within a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two games within 1 month, including the AFC Championship game. So you want to listen to him because this guy is an emerging star as a coach in our league.
Is he a young guy? He's not a young guy.
Yeah, and he had been a defensive back coach with the Giants before coming to the Cincinnati Bengals. And I love his approach. He shares with us his philosophy. I said this, a lot of the great defensive coaches started as secondary coaches. Tony Dungy, Bill Belichick, Tom Landry, Dick LeBeau. Okay? Think about it, okay? You got a Leslie Frazier. You got some other great ones that's still coming up. And Sean McDermott, these guys all got started on the back end because you could see everything from the back to the front. Dick LeBeau used to say there's only two positions in football that get you beat right now, quarterback and defensive backs.
Right.
Because you screw up back there, man. You don't get to make mistakes. Right. And when you can see the game from back to front, particularly in our game now where they're throwing it almost 70% of the time, and you got 6 to 7 DBs out there, right? So you've got to be well coordinated. You can't have miscommunications. You can't have mistakes. And so the game has evolved in a way that coaches like Lou Anaromo, they're beginning the things that he did to Patrick Mahomes twice. Two games in 1 month's time against Andy Reid's offense, I think is sheer genius and should be given a lot more credit.
Yeah, yeah.
He did a number of homes in the playoffs. I know that.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, brother, this has been tremendous. Look forward to catching you, down the road, as they say. And
okay.
You know.
Anytime, guys. You know, anytime. I love coming on with you guys. You guys are – two of my favorites in the business. And Bill, you know, I have all the respect in the world for you. I call you, you're one of the few that are the equivalent to the burning bush in our business, my friend. And that's how I look at it. And Jamal, you're surrounded by greatness. I know you already know that. That's why you're spending so much time. And so we have high hopes for you, man. Great expectations when you're hanging out with the great Bill Rowe.
All right, man. All right, Sal, you take care of yourself, man, and listen to you in the morning.
Yes.
Okay, guys. Take care. All the best.
Monday morning, not tomorrow morning.
That's right.
All right.
Monday through Friday. Take care, guys.
Take care. That was a great Solomon Wilcox. We always have a great time talking to him, man. Sally is great, man. He ought to definitely have his own. I know he's got his own show, but something else, you know. Come on, HBO or something. Yeah, so that was a great Solomon Wilcox. And now we're joined by yet another legend, a friend, former Morgan Bear before he left to go to the other side, but it worked out okay. We call him the Judge. It was Glenn Woods. I'll still always call him Judge Glenn Woods, but he's decided to... he used the word retire. I hate the word retirement, but he uses it freely. But love having him on the show. He always brings a great insight. He brings us a legal insight, good humor, and tremendous insight. So let's welcome to this segment the great Glenn Woods. Glenn, what's
up? Oh, Bill, thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to see you and Jamal again. Jamal looks like he's ready to... take on Steph Curry one-on-one. He's really tightened himself up. He looks great. And Bill, you of course always look like you just got off the field from Coach Banks, man.
The cotton field.
I don't know. Hey, how about this, Bill? I wonder if Jamal knows who Earl Banks is.
I don't know. Do you? I don't think so. I don't think so. The legend didn't reach the North Carolina A&T.
Yeah, that was Bill's famous And seriously, I'm not even being facetious when I say famous football coach at Morgan, when they were routinely, Jamal, playing before 60,000 people at Yankee Stadium.
Right.
Yeah, winning one. And but Earl was part of that great family of great black coaches. Yes. You know, Earl Banks, Eddie Robinson, great Jake Gaither, yep. Big John Merritt down at Tennessee State. You know, they call him the Godfather down at Alcorn. I forgot the Godfather's name, but anyway, but that's that. So listen, Glenn, one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on with two things. We had a long discussion of Deshaun Watson. And I wanted to get your take on it, just A, as a fan, but just legally. I know I wrote a column about it, and somebody, a friend of mine, called me and said, well, he thought that perhaps we were all being too hasty and the NFL was being too harsh because the grand jury couldn't indict it. You know, and what's the saying? Grand jury can indict a ham sandwich, but he was never indicted. But yet the NFL kind of came down on him. So, what's your take on the whole Deshaun Watson saga, which ended last week with an 11-game suspension?
Initially, Bill, the two words that come to mind are tragic and unfortunate. Tragic, I feel very bad for the alleged victims, the women who were making the allegations, and their families. I am very concerned about them. It's unfortunate that a young man who came from very humble beginnings, from a small town in Georgia, is in a very difficult situation now. Granted, he signed a contract, 5 years, $230 million, that is hard to grasp, but he still has put himself in a very, very tenuous, difficult situation. I saw, Bill, where in your writing on Anscape, how initially, back in March of last year, you were willing to give him a little leeway until we got to the bottom of this. And then in the last week or so, you've written that you think he should get 15 games. I've been thinking about it. And if this were... you know, it's difficult because we don't know all of the facts. Judge Robinson wrote that there's case history that constrained her decision to give him, just 6 games. Right. So we don't have all of the facts, all the evidence. We don't have the law in front of us. We don't have the collective bargaining agreement in front of us. So it's tough to make a real accurate, informed decision. But I believe that if I had had anything to do with it, based on what I've read only in the press and only from fine writers like you, not only, but from fine writers like you, I would have required initially a sincere, thorough, lengthy apology from him. That would have been the first thing. Then I would have required, before he ever stepped on a football field, I probably would have required that he go through some sort of serious, lengthy, treatment, mental health treatment, and then I would have required a report back to me to then decide on what the punishment should be. Because what appears to have happened is that The young man must have worked something out before the in the midst of the NFL's appeal of Judge Robinson's ruling. They worked something out. They reached some sort of agreement, some sort of settlement. And Goodell announces the settlement. And then at the press conference subsequent to his announcing the settlement, where Goodell says that the young man understands his failings and his inappropriate behavior and is now ready to improve himself, to work on these things. And therefore, they agreed on a 12-game suspension. Immediately after that, the young man comes out and says that I maintain my innocence. Right. So
I stand on my innocence.
Yeah. So
at that point, you thought I'm sure when you've been on the bench, you've heard this kind of stuff. You know, people trying to express some type of contrition, which you totally were not sold. You've heard a lot of contrition. Some that are sincere, some that are, you said, this guy should be, we should put him under the jail.
Yeah.
So I'm clear that's what you're saying. When you heard this contrition, this wasn't contrite at all.
Well, what I would say is that in issuing decisions, whether it was in civil court, housing court, criminal or juvenile, I always tried to undertake a thorough investigation and always erred on the side of taking your time to reach what is a decision that is fair and just to all. And that's why I'm saying in this case, instead of coming to an agreement, of course, I am doing this now in a after the fact, I would have, before I rendered a decision on his on the length of his punishment, I probably would have wanted to have seen him undergoing treatment, demonstrating contrition and remorse, and really beginning to move in the right direction.
Right.
And then after a certain point in time, I would have asked the parties to report to me on how things were going. And based on that, I probably would have then started a decision process. But of course, I'm saying that having seen that this young man, I'm not going to say violated, but took an action that flew in the face of the agreement that the parties had apparently worked hard to achieve.
Right.
I think that's what I would have done. I would have wanted some proof that he really believed, that he was sincere in his contrition, and that he was actually working hard to improve himself. And then you make the decision.
Right. So in other words, you would have done it the correct way, which is to really dig in, get the information, really attempt to help the individual in some way. Besides what the NFL did, which is basically, what the NFL cares about is games and whether he plays or not. And that was the big deal. How many weeks is he going to miss, when really they missed everything else in terms of, really digging into whether they could help him, whether he's capable of help, finding out as much information as possible, and then getting to whether he's going to be on the field.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I would have done initially. Some might say that is an indefinite suspension which might be a violation of due process. But I would have initially sought time to see just how genuinely remorseful and contrite this young man was, because he's left many people behind him who are really stricken, are suffering. And I saw one New York Times report where they're quoting that there were 66 separate incidents. That's the number I've seen that have come up, and they cover other states than Texas. So this was extensive, and I understand, but you know, the NFL is a business, and this kid is arguably when he's playing, of course, we're going on 2 years that he hasn't played. This kid is arguably the best quarterback in the game, arguably. So they want to get him out there. And we saw that at the time that Cleveland struck a deal with him, there were several other clubs who were actively negotiating. But if you're truly concerned, if you truly, number one, want to do what's right, you're truly concerned about the harm that's been done to these women who made these allegations. And if you're concerned about this kid, as you were saying, Bill, in one of your writings, one of your columns, being scared straight, I think you needed time to look at this. They're not under any time binds, I don't believe. That's one way that I think I would have done it. I would have wanted to have been assured that this kid means business. And because apparently Goodell was thrown and shocked by his statement to the press after the agreement had been struck.
Yeah. Tell me this, Glenn. What would you say to somebody who says that, well, listen, and I preface this at the very beginning, two grand juries in Texas did not indict him. So there's a legal hurdle that he cleared, but the NFL still came down on him with his suspension. Tell us about that. I mean, the legal barrier versus, I guess this is what, a moral barrier or a workplace barrier? Because I guess there have been incidents where maybe you clear a legal hurdle, but your corporation will fine.
Well, I think you've got, I understand that he has not been found criminally to have done anything wrong in a criminal manner. However, there is a binding collective bargaining agreement, an agreement that has been struck between the Players Association and the NFL, which is what they were operating under. The NFL was appealing Judge Sue Robinson's initial arbitration decision when they reached what appeared to be an agreement. So once again, that's what I'm saying. We don't know the actual rules. We don't know what their actual collective bargaining agreement holds. But criminal matters are one thing. Agreements between management and labor in labor cases is a separate thing unto itself. And I think that's what we were seeing here was the implementation of the actions and the work being done and the process being carried out through the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, so the collective bargaining agreement is basically, you know, how, you know, his responsibility to make sure that he doesn't embarrass the league, I would assume something along those lines, where your conduct can't be detrimental to the league, which is basically a PR thing. Right. That's basically a a PR clause.
Well, it's the rules that governs the conduct, the operations of the NFL, and their rules, regulations that have been established between the Players Association and NFL management.
Right. So the way it came, the way it all came out at the end, which you pointed to, him basically not coming across, it doesn't come across as if he understands that he did anything wrong or he's taking any kind of really any type of real responsibility. Everything, any kind of apology he is giving is kind of just like the typical, I'm sorry if I hurt whoever I offended. I apologize to, but I really didn't do anything wrong. And what I like about your original, you know, the way you would have handled it is if you were, is if in the beginning, before you even, before the league, you know, suspends him for any games or anything like that, if you were able to, you know, get him to understand, possibly get him to understand the mistakes that he made, you know, what he actually did wrong, and then therefore allow him to make a heartfelt apology, that might have changed everything. Because really what the NFL is worried about is the PR piece of it.
Right.
And people being, you know, people not, you know, wanting him to pay for what he did because he's not showing any contrition. But let's say if you would have, you know, he would have had counseling beforehand, he gained some understanding of what he actually did wrong, how he was abusive in these circumstances, and he was able to come out with a heartfelt apology that he believed, you might not even had to give him 11 games.
But does that put him in jeopardy, Glenn? If he goes and says that, you know, does that put him in legal jeopardy if he kind of is that contrite and essentially admitting to stuff? I mean, does that put him in legal jeopardy?
Well, I think that I always felt that might have been I don't know. I'm not there once again, but I'm sure that has always been a concern about this for this young man as to how far, what extent he will apologize. Because there might be other cases coming down the pike, we don't know. You know, as I said, when you looking at these cases, you're commenting on these cases, you don't have the facts in front of you. You really don't know what's going on. You have some general idea, but not the specific details. But I think there were two things going on. One, that he doesn't get it. Regardless of how nice a kid everyone says he is, he doesn't get it. There are an extensive number of allegations out there. And as you wrote, Bill, not all of these women can't be wrong. And I think there's always concern of someone in his position that if he comes out and says, look, I'm wrong, I made a terrible mistake, that will be some sort of admission that, that might extend to other cases or even to the cases at bar, the instant cases, these cases. But I think what little I know, instead of going way out and saying, we're going to suspend him for an extended number of games, I probably would have started out by saying he is suspended for X number of games, maybe a small number of games. He is required. I want to hear from counsel, from the parties about a set, established, thorough, genuine schedule for treatment for this young man, and in certain amount of time, I want to report back. We'll reconvene at that time to to revisit the issue, see where he is. But pending that, the young man is not able to play. And meaning, and you know, what I'm saying by that, guys, is that you don't even put it on games. You put it on a date. Meaning, for example, we will reconvene on November 18th, whatever day that is. For example, November 18th is a Friday this year. If just setting that as a theoretical date. And they might say, yeah, but that's so many games. That's not my issue. My issue is to see that this young man gets treatment, gets help. And until the court can ascertain and determine that he has improved, that he is sufficiently contrite and understands, appreciates, the court will hold his status, his current status, as it is.
Yeah. Glenn, just one last thing. I'm not sure which direction to go in, but just your, I know you're a tennis person, just your thoughts on Serena leaving the game. We talk as all of us kind of retirement for, well, I shouldn't put myself in that category, but you've looked in the mirror and you've walked away. What are your thoughts on Serena Williams deciding to give it up?
Well, I understand that it's time for her. She feels it's time for her to give it up. I listened to your interview yesterday on the On Point program on NPR, Bill, and I thought that you and Dr. Gunter really hit the nail on the head that this is difficult for her. And as you wrote also, Bill, her physical limitations at the age of 41 have caught up with her. And as Jamal said at the before we went on, she hasn't been the real Serena in the last 3, 4, 5 years. She had a very, as we know, she had a very difficult pregnancy. She's 41 years old. She was a great, still is.
I think she's 30. What she'll be? What's the age?
I think she's turning 41 or she's 40.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And she and her sister have been great symbols. She's like Tiger. When they come on the screen, we watch. And this is a difficult time for her. Bill expressed his concern about retirement. Jamal, I made the mistake of saying to Bill yesterday that how was he doing in retirement?
I almost disinvited
him. And he corrected me. He strenuously corrected me. But I really meant, I knew he was obviously continuing to work quite hard, but I meant retirement from the New York Times, leaving the.
Well, you know, that's the thing. When you leave a place like that, people figure, well, shit, it's all over.
Exactly.
You know, when you leave the Times, well, wait a minute, there's life after the New York Times.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, but I think that we'll miss Serena. We have to understand it's time. It is. I read her exit writing in Vogue. It's interesting that she is candid about how difficult this is for her. She's very candid about that this is not easy for her. And I was impressed by that. Many times athletes don't tell you that. They withhold that information. But I found it quite enlightening, and I was impressed that she was that candid that about how difficult this has been for her, that she has received counseling. And but I read yesterday where Coco Gauff said that Serena and Venus are the reason she became a tennis player. And and that's her significance. That is her significance.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that we're going to hear a lot of Serena, you know, odes to Serena down the road. And, you know, Judge Woods, we want to get you back. You know, you've got season tickets to the Washington football team. our Commanders. So we'd like to weigh in on that as the season progresses.
Yeah.
And as you actually make your pilgrimage down there to see some games. But appreciate you coming on and giving us your judicial and your legal insight on the fall of Deshaun Watson. And I'm sure there'll be, I guess we'll weigh back in after 11 games.
Well, I think I won't keep you guys. I think the important thing, I guess what I'm saying as far as young Mr. Watson is concerned is, how do we know 12 games is sufficient?
Right.
Right, exactly.
He might need 18 games. Point is that bring him back. Let's see how he's doing. Until a final decision is made, he is suspended. That's the way I would have done it. But remember, they struck an agreement before the appeal of the administrative matter was heard, the collective bargaining matter was heard. They struck a resolution. They reached an agreement. The NFL thought they had a deal down, and we are where we are.
Yeah, and we're out of time for this session. We'd like to thank the legendary Glenn Woods, and obviously my co-host, the great Jamal Murphy. Murph, you want to give us your little spiel about where people can watch us before we sign off?
Yes, of course. Thanks to everybody listening as usual. Appreciate the support. Of course, you can listen to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, wherever you get them. And of course, keep following us and engaging with us on social media at BrosPod on Twitter and at BrosPod on Instagram. And of course, we'll be back next week.
All right, everybody. Enjoy the rest of the summer. Glenn, I look forward to seeing you on the island.
See you in a couple days, Bill.
In a few days. And everybody, continue to be safe, be smart, and God
bless.
Great
to see you, Jamal.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.